You are tuned into Lightly on the Ground Radio on WRIR-LP 97.3 and worldwide at WRIR.org. We're exploring our food system, everything from farm to table. It extends from a seed in a farmer's hand to a bill in the hands of those making policy on the local, national, and worldwide front. I'm Sunny Gardner, and our guest today by Skype is Cale Jaffe, Senior Attorney for the Southern Environmental Law Center. Hey, welcome to Richmond Independent Radio, Cale. Please take a moment and tell us what the Southern Environmental Law Center does for our Commonwealth. What kind of issues does the Environmental Law Center concern itself with?
Oh, an array of environmental issues, public lands, smart growth, energy issues, water quality issues, wetlands protection, essentially using the power of the law to preserve the Southeast's most special resources and special places.
According to the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, Virginia agriculture has an economic impact of $55 billion a year and provides more than 357,000 jobs in the Commonwealth. It's an extremely diverse industry, including poultry, livestock, milk, seafood, peanuts, fruits, vegetables, nursery, field crops, specialty products. Agricultural and forest exports reached an all-time high last year with a total of $2.3 billion, which was a 6% increase from 2010. That is all on an Ag Facts brochure at the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. Mm. How do you think uranium mining might affect agriculture in Virginia?
Well, you know, that's a great question. In fact, last year when this issue was being considered during the 2012 General Assembly session and this past January, the Virginia Farm Bureau actually came out to support keeping the ban until after all of the various studies had been thoroughly evaluated. So they were taking a cautious approach to it precisely because of that issue. Because, let's say you are a cattle farmer and you're investing in high-quality, organic, 100% grass-fed Angus beef is your product. If you've got an open-pit uranium mine and milling facility and uranium mill tailings waste disposal right next door to you in the county one over, that's obviously going to pose a threat to the product that you've put a lot of resources into developing. So that's absolutely been a concern with this issue. And there have been studies, published peer-reviewed work on uranium mine sites out in New Mexico that have shown elevated levels of uranium in cattle that are grazing within the vicinity of uranium milling sites.
Well, you also mentioned water, and one of the issues I keep hearing about when we're discussing the possibility of mining and milling uranium in South Central Virginia is that it's a water-positive place. There's a lot of rain there. There's a lot of hurricanes that pass through there. And New Mexico does not have that problem, and yet you're saying that there's still radiation creeping up the food chain?
New Mexico example is really interesting. It is very different than Virginia, and maybe I'll try to sort of break that down a little bit. Just thinking of sort of the sort of arid Southwest, New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado, where this country has a fair bit of history with uranium mining. That mining started about 1944, towards the end of World War II, and continued into the mid 80s. Obviously, for most of that period, there were no modern environmental laws or protections on the books at all. And so the material was just handled, sort of recklessly with disastrous consequences for the communities out there, and particularly the Navajo communities. There's a lot of mining on Navajo land. Now, obviously, if mining were to go forward today anywhere in the United States, that kind of sort of just reckless disregard for public health and the environment would not be allowed. I mean, there were things like people's foundations to their homes were built on uranium mill tailings waste or mining waste, just sort of egregious stuff like that. So obviously we wouldn't have that kind of mining operation, but what's really telling is that the federal government has spent millions of dollars trying to clean up those sites. Some of them have been declared Superfund sites under federal law. decades of effort to clean them up, and yet still contamination persists. You can go out there today. There are wells on Navajo territory that have huge warning signs on them saying, do not drink this water from this well contaminated by uranium waste. There's a creek. It's called Horn Creek that goes from some of these old uranium sites into the Grand Canyon National Park. And the Park Service's own brochure, you went to the visitor center and picked up a brochure about hiking. It warns you not to drink the water coming out of Horn Creek because of decades-old uranium contamination. The actual language in the brochure says, do not drink this water unless death by thirst is the only other option. So that's the legacy that remains out there. And it's just a reminder of how difficult these issues are to address, especially once contamination occurs.
Yeah, and we can't really predict like we would like to. Tell us a little about the history of the ban here in Virginia.
Sure. The focus has been a lot on this deposit in Southside Virginia in Pennsylvania County, not too far from Danville.
And it's on private land.
It's on private land. It's the what's called the Coles Hill deposit. The Coles family owns it. There are certainly other deposits that have been suspected around the state, though none have been investigated to the extent that the Coles deposit has been studied. There's a Orange County. There was a farmer that was approached, a guy named Bill Speeden, about the same time that the Coles folks were approached. The difference being, Mr. Speeden went out and visited some of these sort of legacy sites out in the Southwest, and decided that he absolutely did not want to bring that to Virginia, and so he's refused to let his property be developed. That's all going on in the late 70s, when the price of uranium was up at around, peaking up at $160 a pound for yellow cake, mm-hmm. which is what you're talking about here. Mm-hmm. So there was an effort to go ahead and start mining it. The General Assembly at the time said, well, wait a minute, this is a whole new ball game here. Let's study this before we go forward. They put a moratorium on the books that absolutely prohibits uranium mining in the Commonwealth.
Was there a time limit on that?
The initial idea was the study would come back after a couple of years, and then we'd reevaluate it. But, of course, what happened was the price of uranium fell. In fact, by 1989, the price of uranium had fallen below $20 a pound and stayed that low clean until 2004. So really what happened was the moratorium was put in place. There were some studies done. There was a bill that was introduced but didn't really move anywhere. Then the price of uranium fell, and the issue just sort of lay dormant for a long time. And it wasn't until 2007, when uranium prices peaked again up to about $140 a pound, that interest in the Coles Hill deposit was renewed, and the industry came back and said, we'd like to go ahead and lift the ban and get started on mining. So in 2008, the General Assembly said no to fast-tracking uranium mining, but instead what happened was the state's Coal and Energy Commission commissioned a study from the National Academy of Sciences to look into some of the public health and scientific and technical issues that we'd face if we went forward with uranium mining in Virginia. And, that study has come out now. There have been public briefings on it around the state. Mm-hmm. I think what I've learned, I've gone through that report. I've gone through it with Bob Burnley, who's a former director of the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality. And I think the report has, it is fair to conclude, the report has abundant evidence and information that strongly supports keeping the ban in Virginia. And so now that's sort of the message that we're bringing back to the General Assembly is, a lot of you said we wanted to wait for the study. That was good. The study is back. That's the National Academy of Sciences study. And if you read it, we think that, it's clear that the risks will greatly outweigh the benefits.
Yeah, some of the language in the executive summary was quite dramatic, describing the dangers, although they could not take a stand on it. They were not contracted. The National Academies of Science was not contracted to take a stand.
Right, and I think that's fair. there's, you know, a lot of people say, well, why didn't the study determine whether it's safe or not safe? And, you know, the problem is that's, it's a bit of, there really is obviously no such thing as something being safe 100% or unsafe 100%. It's all a question of risk management and understanding the risks. And ultimately that becomes a public policy decision, which is sort of what the National Academy said. It said, look, we'll provide you all with the information on this. Is your determination, it's the state's determination, it's the people's determination as to whether the risks that we identify are too great, in which case you don't want to move forward with it, or whether you think those risks are manageable and worth taking, in which case the state would have at it. There are a lot of important quotations from that report. One that sort of jumps out at me goes back to that same issue about hurricanes. You know, that was an issue that we emphasized over and over again, and it's something that appears repeatedly throughout the National Academy of Sciences report.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't mind, I'll just give you this one quotation from the report.
Please.
It says, in a hydrologically active environment, such as Virginia, with relatively frequent tropical and convective storms producing intense rainfall, it is questionable whether currently engineered tailings repositories could be expected to prevent erosion and surface groundwater contamination for 1,000 years. And the reason they mention 1,000 years is because that's the maximum level required by Nuclear Regulatory Commission regulations. They're saying it's questionable, given, you know, Virginia's exposure to hurricanes and other sort of severe weather events, whether we could meet current NRC standards.
And if there were a severe weather event, where would the water slosh the tailings down to? And where, what watershed is this?
Right. Yeah. So if, you know, and again, there are other potential deposits in other parts of the state, but just focusing on the Coles Hill site, that is in the Roanoke River watershed. And in fact, when this issue percolated up, it was such a threat that American Rivers, which is a national organization, put the Roanoke River on its list of 10 most endangered rivers in the nation.
Just because, you know, of the threat of mining uranium in its watershed.
Because of the threat of uranium mining contamination.
So this is essentially the watershed that's just below the James River watershed, which encompasses Charlottesville and Richmond and on out to Hampton Roads. But the Roanoke River watershed goes covers Raleigh and part of North Carolina and down to Virginia Beach.
It gets to Virginia Beach in a bit of a circuitous way.
Mm-hmm.
The river itself flows from southwestern part of the state, coming out of the Blue Ridge, and it angles down very slightly south, crossing the North Carolina border, and empties into Albemarle Sound, which is sort of the northern portion of North Carolina's Outer Banks.
Mm-hmm.
But along the way, there are a couple of reservoirs, including Lake Gaston. There's a pipeline from Lake Gaston that feeds Norfolk, Chesapeake, and Virginia Beach. So there are roughly 1 million people that get their water from that reservoir.
Oh, that's how it works. I didn't realize there was a pipeline. Okay.
Right. So that's the threat to Virginia Beach and to Hampton Roads. Even though they are not in the Roanoke River watershed, they do get their water via pipeline from that watershed. So that's the concern. And the city of Virginia Beach commissioned their own independent study, the engineering analysis, and they essentially wanted to know, you know, what's the worst case scenario? Let's assume, obviously, we're going to try to prevent contamination from happening, but let's say there's a major breach of, one of the landfills that's containing the radioactive mill tailings waste. And the waste, by the way, from these operations that comes out of a uranium mill retains about 85% of its original radioactivities, and plus all the material used to leach the uranium out of the ore. So it's definitely nasty stuff that's difficult to manage. So they're saying, let's say that stuff leaches into the Roanoke River and gets into Lake Gaston because of some sort of catastrophic event, you know, something like Hurricane Camille again, sort of that completely just blows up the containment cell.
Mm-hmm.
What are we looking at for the city of Virginia Beach in terms of our water supply? And their engineer said, your water could fail to meet safe, federal Safe Drinking Water Act standards for as long as a year and a half or 2 years if things go poorly. So that's obviously a pretty significant threat. Virginia, the city has been clear, they're not saying you know, we think this is likely to occur, but, you know, you have to prepare for worst case scenarios. Mm-hmm. I think as everyone learned with the, you know, the BP Gulf oil spill disaster is, you know, things do not always go according to plan. And you've got to prepare for events when they don't go well. So based on their own analysis of the issue, City of Virginia Beach has actually come out strongly in favor of keeping the ban in place and against uranium mining in Virginia.
I'm glad that they've done some objective study on that. You are listening to Lightly on the Ground Radio, and Cale Jaffe is our guest today. He's the senior attorney for the Southern Environmental Law Center. One thing that sticks in my mind, Cale, is the eternity of any decision to open pits of radioactive material. I've heard Bob Burnley and a couple of other people use the word forever. Mm-hmm. And when we're talking about 50,000 years, it is forever as far as cleaning up after such a disaster. We actually have to monitor the waste and monitor all the materials involved for basically forever. And that would ultimately fall to the government, because companies don't go on forever. If a company is stressed, it'll just go bankrupt. And
These are good and important questions and tough questions. I mean, one, it helps, I think, to frame what it is we're really looking at here. The industry likes to say, oh, this is about providing fuel for Virginia. And that's really sort of a misleading way to describe it, because what would be produced at a mill site here would be yellow cake.
That's the world's commodity. It's traded worldwide, right?
It's a globally traded commodity. So then what happens there is that yellow cake then goes to an enrichment facility. The closest one to us is there's an old one in Paducah, Kentucky. At the facility, the yellow cake then gets enriched to a point where it can be processed into fuel pellets and then into fuel rods and essentially be made into nuclear fuel. And then that gets, you know, the fuel from, you know, for example, the place in Paducah is sold all over the world. So the yellow cake gets exported. That's what, you know, everyone else gets. What Virginia gets, what stays here in perpetuity, is the waste. You know, I don't know if you remember a few years ago, sort of mid-90s or thereabouts, there was the state looked really seriously at this question of barging trash up the James River. And there were, a lot of legislators that worried about this. Because they thought it would tarnish sort of Virginia's legacy and image. And, you know, the issue that kept getting thrown out there, that Virginia was the second largest importer of out-of-state trash, and that this was something that the legislature was concerned about. You know, the way I see this issue, it's essentially sort of a more radioactive version of the same question. I mean, do we want to be the uranium waste disposal capital of the American East Coast? Because that's sort of what the proposal really is when you get right down to it.
That doesn't sound good for agribusiness or tourism.
it definitely makes it a harder sell. To get back to one thing you raised, which was the hurricane issue.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something, as I said, it's a big issue in the National Academy of Sciences report. water is obviously a huge issue whenever you're trying to sort of manage this waste in perpetuity. And, you know, the uranium industry has some experience in mining, for example, up in northern Saskatchewan, in these very remote areas. You know, some of those mine sites are maybe 400 miles from any major city, which would be Saskatoon. Saskatoon's about the size of Durham, North Carolina. So, you know, they're talking about sites that are very remote in northern Saskatchewan. And there's a lot of water up in northern Saskatchewan, a lot of lakes. But what you don't have is these, you know, sort of massive deluges, these sort of acute events of extreme weather that you get here in Virginia with a hurricane or a tropical storm. You know, I don't know how many people remember, you know, your listeners were living in Richmond in 2004 and remember when Hurricane Gaston, then Tropical Storm Gaston, parked itself on top of Richmond mm-hmm. and dumped about 14 inches of rain. You remember those pictures of Shaco Bottom just completely flooded, cars completely flooded, you know, businesses destroyed. Imagine a rain event like that right on top of an active mine and mill operation. You know, you can't just throw a tarp over it and be okay. It's, you know, that's going to be a very, very tricky situation to try to handle. Mm-hmm. And the National Academy's report was, yeah, there are a lot of unknowns.
Well, Cale, what can citizens do if they take this under advisement? Say a listener wants to not have uranium mining 150 miles from Richmond. What can we do?
There was a public hearing down in Chatham just Monday night, mm-hmm. Which is the town closest to where the mine site would be. And there was one of the local citizens who lives in that community and has been active in fighting this proposal, got up at the public hearing and said, you know, we're talking about all these different potential regulations and different laws. He said, you know, we only need one law, and we've already got it. It's the ban. Just keep that one law in the books, and we don't need the rest of this stuff, which I thought was a great observation. And so what, you know, I think folks can do is contact their representatives in the House of Delegates, contact their state senators, and contact the governor and say, I've looked at this. I don't want it here in Virginia. I want to keep the ban. No matter what happens, the ultimate decision right now, because on the books in Virginia there's a ban on the books, nothing can happen unless the General Assembly changes that law. And so encourage the General Assembly to maintain the status quo on this and keep that ban in place.
And to learn more about it, they could visit keeptheban.org. Is there information on your website, Cale?
Yeah, and we certainly, you know, the Keep the Ban website that you mentioned, keeptheban.org, is a great spot to go. It is a sort of a location that has brought all the various groups that have been involved in the Keep the Ban coalition together. There's great information there. There's also information on our website, you know, southernenvironment.org, as well as, you know, a lot of the coalition partners that we're working with. But Keep the Bans is a great place to go to start with, to really find out, to find what you're looking for.
There's another thing I wanted to ask you about, and it sounds like, I mean, all of these studies must take money. There's the Chmura study, the National Academies of Science study, and there's a new study going on by the Uranium Working Group, which is part of the Coal and Energy Commission. How are these being paid for? Do you have any idea about that?
You know, I mean, I've looked a little bit into it. The main study, the sort of the National Academy of Sciences study, for example, was funded in part was money, actually, you know, Virginia Uranium Inc., the company that wants to mine, mm-hmm. Had essentially put the money in a fund that was then funneled through Virginia Tech, which was actually the fiscal agent working with the National Academy of Sciences. And the National Academy was pretty aggressive in making sure that, you know, that their independence be protected. So, you know, to be honest, I was not concerned with the fact that, you know, the state didn't have the money to bring that on, and VUI very much wanted to study because they knew that they didn't have a shot at getting their project moving without legislators having an opportunity to review a study. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was very pleased with the National Academy's process and product. You know, I attended almost all of their public meetings, and they were excellent about, one, getting buy-in from all sides, sort of environmental groups, the industry, downstream communities like Virginia Beach. Everyone really had buy-in to the National Academy's process. Mm-hmm. They also, unlike any of the other studies out there, made sure to have their study independently peer-reviewed. So they put together a panel of experts from across the spectrum, and then they wrote the report, and then that report went to a separate peer review panel to look it over before it was released to the public. So, you know, my sense is that, you know, there were a lot of legislators said they wanted to wait for the study. That was the study they were waiting for. You know, to be candid, I think part of the reason Virginia Uranium has pushed the governor to do another sort of working group study was that they didn't like the result of the first one, and so they want to do it again to get a result that suits them. The study that everyone waited for is already out there. That's the National Academy's report. That's really the gold standard.
And where could someone go to read something about that?
There was, you know, I don't remember the website off the top of my head, mm-hmm. but it is, if you go to the National Academy's press website, it is there,
right.
Which is nap.edu.
Well, Cale Jaffe, I really appreciate your overview of this process and making the time to talk with us here on the radio. And I want to remind listeners that to participate in the discussion, you can email your thoughts to sunny@wrir.org. And this episode was recorded at Richmond Independent Radio with Cale Jaffe in the Southern Environmental Law Center offices, and it's broadcast on WRIR-LP FM 97.3 and WRIR.org. You can befriend us on Facebook by joining a Lightly on Ground radio group, where you can also find some links to the organizations and publications that we just discussed. The theme music is Bonefire Dance by Rattlemouth, and the incidental music was Yucca Mountain, which is about Yucca Mountain, by Theories of the Old School. I hope you'll join us again on the radio, and until then, walk in the light and live lightly on the ground. Thank you, Cale Jaffe, for coming.
Thank you very much.
And keep up the good work out there.
Certainly, and you as well.
Thank you, and thank you for listening.